You're listening to Meeting Pod, the podcast powered by Meeting Place, the premier magazine and news source for the meat and poultry processing industry, and Alt Meat Magazine, the only business information resource for the exploding alternative meat industry.
Hi, I'm Lisa Keefe, editor-in-chief of Meeting Place and Alt Meat. Welcome to this month's Meeting Pod episode dedicated to the meat alternatives market. Alt meat companies have learned in the last year or so just how expensive it can be to build a food manufacturing company from the ground up. Some have learned the hard way, having to sell off plant and equipment, or pulling the plug before the project even is finished. The phrase popular with founders and funders alike these days is asset light. But what does that actually mean? CRB's Tony Moses is back with us on Meeting Pod to discuss the options for actually manufacturing this stuff that was invented in a lab. How to lower costs, how to calculate those costs accurately, and why a thorough TEA can help keep a company out of financial trouble. Tony, thank you again for being a guest on Meeting Pod. It's always informative and a delight to have the chance to talk with you about the infrastructure that surrounds this particular part of the food sector.
Thanks, Lisa. It's my pleasure to be here, and I always enjoy talking with you, so thanks for having me.
Always. So in the alternative sector, we're sort of seem to be going through a period of, you know, I think we can call it retrenchment. And in this alternative meat sector in particular, everybody seems to be talking about asset light business growth. And I guess I want to talk a little bit about what that means for alt meat startups and early stage businesses. And first I'll ask, why has this become a front burner issue and why it wasn't more of a consideration or talked about more often earlier in the growth of this market?
Yep. I think there's a multitude of reasons that are just converging on us now. The first is capital is so much harder to find right now. I think that is everybody's seeing that. That's kind of manifesting in several ways. One is higher interest rates. So it's just more expensive to take out loans and borrow that money. But the second is the retrenchment also in venture capital funding. So at one point, that industry was willing to take big risks, especially on the sector. The appetite for risks has diminished. So we're seeing less funding and fewer players funding. So I think that access to capital is a big part of it. But I also think that as this industry is maturing and founders are growing more savvy, there's just a different approach to capital. So they're seeing that this makes more sense perhaps to do more of a stage-wise investment process and take that kind of precious capital they've raised and use it to fund their teams, to bring on the right talent, as well as to build inventory. That takes money too, and that's all kind of competing for the same pot, so to say. And then this is a personal opinion for me too, but I think the kind of last reason I'd say is the approach to IP, I feel, is changing a little bit. Initially, people were much more likely to want to manufacture in-house and protect that, where now there's kind of more partnerships and trust within the industry, so people are frankly more open to it as well.
Do you think that people are more trusting with their IP, or do you think they have to form these partnerships in order to stay alive?
It may be a little bit of both. You know, I think the food industry in general, the approach to IP is very different than maybe the tech sector, and especially the biopharmaceutical sector, where in food and beverage, you tend to see far fewer patents. A lot of that IP or know-how comes sometimes from the equipment vendor or other people with general food background knowledge. And so I think some of the founders that are in this sector aren't used to that. They were coming from tech or pharmaceuticals, where a lot of that IP was locked up in patents and highly protected. So I think there is a genuine kind of openness to it, but there is a necessity to form those partnerships as well, just to be commercially viable.
Certainly with money being as tight as it is. I want to ask a basic question to make sure that I understand. There's the CapEx part of the investment, but then there's OpEx, the operations expenditures. And when you're talking about the people and the research and like the input and maybe the legal around getting IP patents, if that's a factor, would that all basically anything other than equipment and buildings come under OpEx then?
Yes, generally. Yep. And then raw material costs as well.
Okay. Yep. Now, when we talk about asset light or getting your money from a venture capitalist and trying to invest a bigger piece of that pie into operations instead of, you know, the equipment, the infrastructure, can you run down some options for what that definition means for different companies? What does it mean at the company level if to be truly asset light?
Yep. The context that I tend to hear this in now is more in asset light manufacturing. I mean, you could be asset light for your office building too, right? Where you would lease instead of own it. But this, it tends to be more on the manufacturing basis. And I'd say the definition that I described to it is that your company owns as few manufacturing assets as possible to make that product. It's not that you're going all manual labor and making everything by hand. You're just kind of using assets that other people own to make that product. That could be using a supplier to make a higher value added product. For example, if you're making an extruded product, can they provide the TVP? Or can they even provide seasoned or batter breaded fried TVP so you don't have to do that in-house? Or it could be contracting with a contract manufacturer or a co-man or co-packer and having them do that using their assets. It's not truly globally asset light. It's more from the perspective of your company. How do you own as few physical assets as possible for your manufacturing?
Is that strictly the manufacturing? Can that definition of asset light also extend to maybe you're leasing your laboratory equipment as well? Maybe you're leasing the lab space, you are renting your office furniture? Are we talking the big money is really in the manufacturing?
I think the big money is in the manufacturing, but for sure that mentality can. And even I love that thought, leasing the lab space, leasing the office space, even potentially working at a university to do some of your R&D or a supplier's technical center to do some of your R&D. Those can be costly, especially to an early stage startup. So I think that's a great thought. And I don't know that it's one that's typically considered. I think most of the time it's manufacturing, but yeah, by all means, think about that in terms of your R&D as well. Yep.
So are there other options? I mean, can you rent the equipment and put it in a space or rent time on equipment that might be installed somewhere else? Or
absolutely. There's a lot of creative options out there. So there are now places where you can just rent time facilities. So on a manufacturing basis, that would be a contract manufacturer, but you can also do it from an R&D perspective as well. You can even, this is not quite asset light, but you could even contract some of human resources to do that as well. So to work with a contract R&D provider as well, that reduces the risk of salaries and overhead if you're really trying to be lean there. You can lease space. So I've seen some startups lease the space that they're operating in. The mentality there is that it is what they need for the next few years to get growing and get established. At some point in time, they will likely have to move out of that space, but it's just a lower risk. It reduces maybe the amount of capital that they have to raise. Instead of building that building, they're just leasing that space temporarily. And then there's a lot of, now we're seeing more options to lease equipment, especially on the packaging side of things. We're seeing some companies just offer packaging lines that you can lease for a year or two. Mixing equipment is common there too. And then we're even seeing some automation systems where they will lease the instruments and controls and infrastructure for automating a process as well. So this helps kind of reduce that capital risk and having to fundraise for the entire capital project. Rather, you can just fundraise for the next couple of years of that kind of smaller production model.
I'm imagining that these processes are rather more complicated than, say, leasing a car, that when you're talking about pieces of equipment and they have to work together and they have to integrate with, you know, the building that they're in, what are some of the challenges to contract manufacturing or leasing equipment for your own use, going that route?
You hit the nail on the head there. Getting the capacity and the capabilities matched throughout that production process is a huge challenge. So a lot of times if you're leasing something, the equipment is out there, you'll have to design around the size or the throughput or the rate of that equipment. You'll Typically, it's food grade, so you're going to be okay with that. But if you think of something like a packaging line, you might have an idea of a certain package format that you're going to launch in, even package sizes. And you have to make sure that all that matches. So when you buy new, you get a specifier that you can even think kind of outside the box. You know, if you're doing, you know, a frozen bag product, you can think about how do I take this all the way from C-store to club and get the right change parts for that. A leased or rented piece of equipment might not be the most up to date. Those change parts might not exist anymore. So sometimes leasing equipment really constrains your business model, both in how much you produce and what type of product you produce, and even the outlets that you can go to if you're constrained with the size of your product, or, you know, even getting into like a club warehouse. Oftentimes they'll want to just put the pallet on there and pull the side of the corrugate off. So it could even restrict the types of club stores that you could sell in, for example.
And that's sort of the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, I think, for a lot of food manufacturers, as I understand it. Contract manufacturing, it's great if you can find a great partner, but I understand that finding that capacity is not out there in the abundance that it used to be. Is that part of the market also feeling pretty tight?
I'd say it's diverged a little bit for the different categories of alt meat. So I'd say for plant-based meat, there's a little bit more capacity now than what we saw maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And part of that is just been demand for the product has dropped over the last couple of years. But we've also seen some new facilities come online as well. So kind of a mixed story there. The devil is in the details there, though. Typically, you need an extruder for plant-based, but there's a lot that you can do downstream of that extruder. So you really have to make sure that those other capabilities and capacities match what you need. Mm-hmm. I'd say for the mycelium-based and the cultivated meat spaces, there's still major lack of capacity to significant scale. I even heard people call it the cost-capacity conundrum, where you need to get to a certain scale to achieve a certain cost, and it's just not out there right now. We're seeing, especially outside the US, more facilities come online that are in about 10,000 kiloliter scale. I think most companies would look at that as a bit of kind of a large pilot plant or kind of a demo facility. So it's a good option to launch product there. You have to think about how do you form your mycelium-based or cultivated meat product after it comes out of that bioreactor, your distribution pathways. So if you're doing that in Singapore and your markets in the Europe or the US, you have to think about the transportation costs there. You know, with cultivated meat, we have this extra barrier of regulatory approval. So you need to work with the manufacturer to make sure that it's acceptable for sale in whatever country you're working in. So I'd say you've got the sliding scale for plant-based through mycelium to cultivated of kind of ease of manufacturing at a contract manufacturer, both for capacity as well as regulatory reasons.
You know, that raises the question, because I have read some materials that indicate that level of capacity or lack of capacity is different in different regions of the globe. So looking at the U.S. market, how quickly do you imagine, for example, the infrastructure for fermentation to grow or even for cultivated? Or are we also seeing that there's a reluctance to add to that capacity because of the interest rates and the VC consolidation and that sort of thing?
There is a bit of reluctance out there, but it's an interesting situation. I think if I could predict, I would say that we're going to see some interesting kind of partnerships or tie-ups here. What the U.S. lacks, I'd say, right now is a contract manufacturer that has the capability to take multiple companies or parties and produce in their space. There is capacity, though, for bioreactors, both in mycelium products and cultivated, but those typically reside within the branded company's assets. So there's not, let's say, a shared space or contract manufacturer that can take, you know, anybody that makes sense through their door. the prediction that I think we might see is some of those companies with that capacity start to partner up with those that lack it and use their products or manufacture some of their products for a fee through their facilities. I thought for the cultivated space right now, we'd see more products on market as we saw approvals over the last year and a half, and we just haven't seen much outside of a couple restaurants. So that would tell me that those companies that have that capacity aren't fully using it, and they'll want to realize some value outside of that too. So a wild prediction, but I could see that being a good tie-up or partnership with companies that are looking to at least demonstrate and establish a market going to companies that aren't fully using their capacity there.
Well, that's interesting. So we're sort of looking at fermentation or cultivation as a service.
Yep.
Should we be looking for that to come on the market imminently, or is that just this could happen and we're still waiting to see if somebody takes this step?
My read from talking with people at different conferences is that those talks are underway right now. So I would say it's more of an imminent thing.
Interesting. We'll keep an eye out. Now, for those companies that decide that they are going to buy or have bought the equipment, are there some technique or ways to approach it to minimize the effect of those purchases on their cash flow?
Yeah, I would say you want to look for equipment that's going to be really versatile and be used in a lot of different production steps. So for example, a mixing step, you might look for a mixer that can do both liquids and solids potentially if those are in your process. So something that can kind of work in two steps of that production process. Might look for cutting and grinding. Can you switch plates out and get different sizes out of that? Even something like a bowl chopper might be able to do particle size reduction and mixing for you at the same time. So I would look for things that can do that. Where I think it gets to be a challenge is maybe some of your signature pieces of equipment, your bioreactor, your extruder. Those certainly won't be doing double duty as choppers or mixers. I'd say look at those auxiliary pieces of equipment, especially things that use a lot of labor. You might get a pretty quick payback on relatively low investments there.
Oh, that's an interesting approach. So, but if I have a bioreactor and I am making my product in it, there is a need for sterility and also to avoid allergens and that sort of thing. So does that end up becoming a consideration if you have a bioreactor capacity and you want to lease it out to another company? It seems to me like the types of companies that could take advantage of that would be very narrowly defined.
You can have different allergens in the same facilities, but it has to be pretty carefully managed. So you have to make sure that your scheduling is adequate to keep those segregated in production, that your cleaning protocols are sufficient and validated to show that you've completely removed one allergen before you start the next. And then even your storage, you want to make sure that you're storing allergens separately. But we see that the same facility can be used for multiple allergens. That there are certainly some considerations for that too, especially ones that have high dust, or the ability to really produce a lot of dust. Those can get airborne, those can get into ductwork. That can be very difficult to clean. So you want to make sure that you have the right procedures around that and the right containment, right cleaning.
Are there elements as part of some sort of alternative meat process that once airborne could become combustible?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yes, that's a great question. What comes to mind immediately are any of your protein isolates, if you're using starches, finely ground sugars. Solids aren't often overlooked combustible material. And then I'd say on the mycelium and cultivated side, your media, I'd look at that. That could be, especially if it's a solid or powderized material. Yep. Mm. Anything that gets airborne very easily is something you want to look at.
Well, that sort of leads me to sort of another whole area of expenses and capital operations. You know, those ongoing expenses, and we're talking about, you know, the electrical costs, the maintenance of the equipment and the facility around it, waste streams, fire suppression or prevention opportunities. Do you find that these early stage companies have really thought about that, or does it sort of come as a surprise that not only do you have to have you bought the house, but now you have to pay for the heating and the cooling and the landscaping every month on top of that?
Yeah, it's almost like you bought the furniture and now have to build the house and pay for the heating and the landscaping. Yeah.
There you go.
The general answer to that is yes. Oftentimes it's a surprise to startup. It depends on kind of the leadership team's experience in operations and capital projects. But a lot of times we'll run into companies that have just looked at the processing equipment costs, aka the furniture. And that tends to be a quarter to a third of the total cost of a capital project if you're going to do a greenfield. So all the supporting utilities, like you said, the steam, the electricity, and then the lead times, believe it or not, electrical components have some of the longest lead times right now. And I think part of that is just the food and beverage industry is using the same components that the semiconductor industry is using, right? We all need transformers for power. So there's a lead time component to that as well. And then, you know, in terms of operating costs, just a general rule of thumb is your raw materials are about half to two thirds of your operating costs. So your labor, your utilities, and then your depreciation from your capital all kind of bake into that final half to third that makes you whole there. So that's typically a surprise. Now, I have to say the industry is evolving. We're seeing a lot more companies talk about a TEA or a techno-economic analysis. And this is traditionally the food industry is referred to COGS or cost of goods sold model here. And this is something that accounts for all of that and bakes it in. And I think this is part of the evolution of the industry is that owners, investors are both getting more savvy and starting to think about what does commercial success look like? It might not be tomorrow, but there needs to be a path towards that. So that tends to now accompany more and more capital projects is to show, hey, if I'm going to invest in this, show me that it's going to pay off when we're at a certain capacity.
That's interesting. Tell me more about the TEAs. And is this particularly a consideration in the alt meat sector as opposed to other food and beverage manufacturing sectors? And what all might be involved in a thorough TEA analysis?
You know, I think it's unique to alt meat to use the term TEA. And I think it has its roots in kind of the tech industry, where a lot of kind of the most recent wave of investment and founders, we just had a lot of talent and the capital come from that. So I think that's kind of an adoption from that. What you see in a successful TEA, there are all the different elements of what goes into the cost of producing, both direct costs and indirect costs. So direct cost would be the raw materials, the labor, anything that is actually kind of made has to be there to form the product. The indirect costs are things like the capital depreciation, maybe the plant manager's salary. If you really, it'd be taxes, it'd be, or a lease on the building, things like that. So all of that is going to be baked in to that cost. And then what the beautiful thing that comes with that is it forces you to look at your capital costs as well. So if we were going to a contract manufacturer, they might just say, Tony, Lisa, you buy your own raw materials, and here's the conversion cost per pound if you meet this volume a year. So our TEA in that case is really simple. If we have to buy a dicer to put in line with that, great. Then that's, we can add that onto the TEA. If we were going to build new though, that would force us to calculate our capital cost because we need to convert that to an annual depreciation and add that to our product cost. So with a TEA, you really do need your capital costs. If you don't have them and you're going to a contract manufacturer, great. You don't have to worry about it. But if you're building new, you need to include those capital costs and it forces you to think through that entire model. And the interesting thing now too is there's instances in the academic literature where people are talking about a TEA. And so they're showing you different ways to model that. So we're kind of getting some different industry standards out there. And there's even modeling software, commercial modeling software that can do all this for you. And so we would look at that as kind of a first line TEA, right? It's going to use kind of general rules of thumb to get your capital costs and things like that. But at least it would be something that would tell you if you're way off the mark in terms of having a successful commercial product or business at the scale or the method that you were planning to launch in.
So even once you have a TEA, it's as if that information is now static. You can start to use that as a tool to look at different categories and how you might be able to reduce those.
Yes, yes, right on. And so I think that's really important for the cultivated meat industry in particular right now. It applies to plant-based meat, but let's say you come back and your TEA doesn't work. You're not going to be financially viable. You can almost do a sensitivity analysis and say, hey, if I can bring my titer up by X%, or if I can bring my media cost down Y%, or something like that, it gives you some levers to pull and even set some development targets for your team or some milestones. Let's say you come back from a plant-based and you're like, I have a great product. I have great branding. It's going to work. Your first year on the market, you're losing money, but by year three, you're breaking even. And by year five, you've got a 10% margin. You can at least show this path and say, here are the things that I need to achieve, the milestones that I need to hit by these years to achieve a commercially viable business.
Mm-hmm. So is it possible that the TEA and the elements, some of those external costs, things like your electrical utilities and your air usage, steam, the filtration, the transportation, are those also levers that can be pulled? Are those more fixed?
Yeah, they absolutely are. The transportation is a great one too, especially if you're starting out and you're saying, I'm going asset light for my manufacturing model. That might mean I can only find a bioreactor, Los Angeles, and I need somewhere to turn that into a meat product, and that's in Salt Lake. And then my primary market is going to be Virginia, right? So that's a lot of transportation to get that product to, you know, Metro DC or wherever you're taking it. So you can say, hey, I can manufacture, you know, by year three, if I can find manufacturing capacity in Salt Lake for my bioreactor, I've just cut that off. Yep, it absolutely is. You can even look at where you want to manufacture based on your utility rates. Those tend to be a pretty minor component, but if you're talking about potentially a point or two of margin, that's, I think, worth having a conversation about that.
What you're describing in terms of, you know, moving the product in different process stages of the processes from LA to Salt Lake City and then to Virginia, I'm thinking that sounds crazy, but under the current circumstances in the industry, that's probably not an unusual set of circumstances.
No, unfortunately. I think that especially if you have a fermentation or cultivated protein with the capacity being what it is, it could be even worse. You could be talking about a bioreactor in Europe and then moving that to Virginia. So I don't think it's that crazy. And that's something when we talk with clients where we say, can your business be viable if you have this kind of disjointed supply chain and get yourself established and show that there's not a big risk in investing capital and then get the dollars to do that once you've got a product on market?
It's an age-old question, which comes first, the capacity or the demand?
I know this is the model that we have in food right now isn't great because look, some people can start these businesses in a commercial kitchen down the street and sell at a corner store. And I don't know of any commercial kitchens with bioreactors or extruders in them.
Right. It's a different animal.
It is.
Is this rather squeezed state of affairs? How long do you think this will, is this permanent or is this a long, how is this going to roll out, do you see, based on your experience in the industry?
I think that this squeeze state is permanent or long term. That just the risk appetite that we saw 3 to 5 years ago, I think was an extraordinary circumstance. Yep. And by that, it's around venture capital investing hundreds of millions potentially in a brick and mortar facility. That's unusual, I think, for any industry. But also you saw some companies just overnight want to stand up a whole new division in this sector instead of grow into it or acquire something small and scale it. So I think what we'll go back to that model. I'm not saying the investment and all that is dead, but I think we'll go back to a state where venture is more about getting the prototype out there. And then maybe you're looking more towards private equity or established CPG company once you have the brand and have a market there. So more of like I heard somebody call it like a climbing a ladder, but you don't get to skip a rung anymore or a set of rungs.
And it was probably a little more dangerous than you wanted to admit to skip a rung in the first place.
Absolutely.
It's 2024. What do you expect in this sector between now and Christmas?
Now and Christmas. Okay. So in the next 9 months, we think that capital spending will be muted for Altmeet. We're about to publish our Horizons report in May, and we looked at capital spending across a variety of submarkets. And for sure, for Altmeet, over half of companies weren't looking to spend more than $5 million on a project, on a single project. And almost 60% were limiting their total capital spending to $20 million a year. Those numbers are double alt dairy and the rest of the food and beverage. So muted capital spending. There'll still be capital spending out there, but it's going to be strategic and just to kind of support general growth. I do think we'll see some consolidations here. I think we started to see a few. It's tough to talk about that. You don't want to be the person predicting it, but I think it'll be really like across the supply chain. So it's not necessarily going to be just branded companies coming together, but it's going to be people consolidating production. We have to see it on the plant-based side because we've just seen volumes drop in this category now for several years, year after year. And so those companies will have to do it to stay viable. Mm-hmm. But I think on the plus side, I think it's going to be a really telling year. And we're going to see a couple, I think, exciting examples of commercial success emerge. So we've seen, you know, mycelium-based meat get into Target with this broad distribution, right? So there's going to be some awesome lessons to learn there. We've seen some of the majors in this space go through really significant rebranding efforts, and they're starting to use studies and medical endorsements for their products to differentiate. So I'm seeing this kind of spark of innovation happen with kind of the majors out there. And then even some of the startups, there's still money to be had out there, right? Just in the last week, two companies announced that they had raised money. And what I think sets them apart is that they've got technology platforms that they believe will differentiate their products or their equipment in the marketplace. So there's a lot of challenge in the market right now, but I think we're starting to see the sparks of kind of the next wave and what's going to work. There's been some companies that have done really well too through this, but I think we're seeing that next wave of innovation happening, but it's a little bit quieter than the last one. So when we look back at the sector in the new year, or kind of do our year in review, I think we're going to be able to point to a couple things and say, ooh, look what just emerged from that, and see some companies kind of mimic and then innovate off of those successes.
That's very interesting. I'm looking forward to January 25 when I can look back at 2024 and go, wow, that came out of the market and it's really cool. And that gives us a new direction to go into.
Yeah, I think it'll be there.
Great. Well, Tony, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate the insights, and we will check in again toward the end of the year, I'm sure, and see how it's unfolding.
That's right. Yep. Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks, Tony.
As Tony has made clear, asset light may be an attractive manufacturing option, but it's not without its drawbacks. You can read more about the nuts and bolts of novel food construction on the Altmeet website at alt-meet.net. You can also go there to subscribe to our daily newsletter and bi-monthly print magazine dedicated to the business of alternative meats.
Remember to tune in on Mondays to get the inside track on the people and the processes that drive the protein industry. Be sure to subscribe to Meeting Pod on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow Meeting Place and Altmeet Magazines on social media, and be sure to visit our websites at meetingplace.com and altmeet.net.